These days, cartoonists have myriad choices in terms of what kinds of tools they want to use to make their stories. They can use computers, they can use ink wash, they can use acrylic, they can use oils even.
Yep.
Lots of different tools at your disposal. So is there a reason that you like using watercolor? And I'm going to guess there's one of two or maybe both reasons. Is one, you like what it communicates, or two, you like the experience of using it. Is it both? If so, why? If it's only one, why?
It absolutely is both. We had talked a little bit about, when we had talked about watercolor once before, you had mentioned that, you can get the same effects with Photoshop, right?
Absolutely.
And that's absolutely true.
And you have undos. You have undos when you use Photoshop.
That's the thing,
so
right?
It's like...
So why would you do so that we can get the same effect with actual watercolor? And, there's kind of two reasons, and they both boil down to the same thing. The first thing that I always think of is, like, of all the mediums that I've used, watercolor is maybe the most frustrating as a coloring medium, and that is actually the reason. There are no undos when you're working with traditional media. And with watercolor especially, since you've got water and it's actually kind of flowing on a page, the paint itself, the watercolor itself, is in partial control of what you're doing. You're not completely in control. And that is very frustrating, but I also think it's actually kind of good for me. And I enjoy doing picture books. I tend to work graphic novel, I've only done two picture books, but I feel like I'm falling into a rhythm of graphic novel, picture book, graphic novel, picture book. And the graphic novels are digitally colored, and I feel like at the end of those, I want to do something that's a little bit more completely tactile, or something like the watercolor, where it's where there are no undo buttons, and you kind of have to keep an eye with. When you do have an undo button, you can actually push yourself so much harder. You can keep going and going and going because you can undo it. With the watercolors, when we're doing an illustration like this, you kind of have to even monitor your own exhaustion levels. Because once you get too tired and you start making a lot of mistakes with the watercolors, you can't undo those mistakes. if you just work yourself into the ground with digital coloring, you can come back the next day and be like, oh, that page is terrible, so I'll just redo this, right?
That's right. That's right. You go back to an earlier state.
So maybe you're a little more gentle with yourself when you're working with something else being a little bit more in control.
I never thought of it that way.
I think it's true.
It forces you to be more careful about your own self care.
Yeah.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
There's a pleasure in you using certain tools. I wonder if you could talk about that. Like, it's not just ergonomics. It's just like, oh, I put a squishy thing in the end of my pencil and my fingers aren't tired. But there's a certain kind of way, like certain tools interact with each other that actually inform the work and inform the experience of making the work. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah, and that's a personal thing too, I think. I mean, people connect. There's no rhyme or reason that I can find to what medium or tools that you are going to end up connecting with. I've seen such beautiful work done with Croquill pens, but I don't like them at all. I don't connect with those, and I tend to jab them through the paper, and I have all these terrible experiences with them, and it just ruined them for me. And then for a long time, I do a little bit of brush inking, but I used to never do that, and now all of a sudden, it's sort of like broccoli. Like, growing up, I hated broccoli, and then I got older, and all of a sudden, I was like, oh, it's actually really good. And that's how I feel about, maybe I'll feel that way about Croquill pens at some point.
But that's the neat thing. Like, yeah, there's always another tool to try.
It does,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, but to round back on something you were saying earlier about no undos, Ben, I got to make it perfect. If I don't make it perfect, it's not good. And if it's not good, then nobody's going to want to read it. So it has to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about...
Agreed. No, I'm just kidding.
Great.
So, work harder. No, go ahead.
This idea of like letting the watercolor actually do stuff that you didn't expect.
Yeah.
You're not in control, therefore it's not perfect.
Right. And I feel like the lesson there is, I don't know, for me the lesson there, and I don't know, I feel like the lesson might be there is no perfect. Perfect is a thing that you can chase that doesn't really exist. Because what I've found with a lot of projects is you work with them and you work on them until, the projects with deadlines, you work on them until somebody tells you, no, I need that. And so you have to turn it in, you know? And there are things, in Nobody Likes a Goblin, there was no digital work done to the book at all, unless you count laying in the text. And I guess, like, I did these as spot illustrations, and they end up on all black pages, so there was, like, a background put. But the illustrations themselves, there was no digital work. But if you look, a couple of these have notes that I left. The little swamp battle scene actually has a couple notes I made to myself of things that I wanted to change, things that were not in continuity. There was, like, ears missing on one of the goblins. So, like, the character design changed a little bit, and I'd made notes to go back and correct that. It never got done.
Show of hands, who here noticed that the ear was missing?
Oh, there's one. There's one.
But, like, what?
But it's okay. I mean, right. I'm actually kind of happier in the end that there were no changes, you know? Like, it was kind of like... it's kind of like flying by the seat of your pants or whatever. You know, what you see is what you did.
Okay. Let's talk about... Oh, go ahead.
Perfection. Hunter. I don't know. So that's my idea about perfection is that there's maybe a... I guess it's the same as the watercolor. There's a joy in letting the world influence you, right?
Yeah.
And the medium itself.
There's a famous cartoonist named Neil Adams who once said that your style is what you do wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that.
You have this story about a goblin who is at home, he's having a good time with a skeleton friend, and all of a sudden these marauding heroes come in. Let's talk about fearlessness. Heroes are fearless, right? Heroes say, that's a problem, I'm the one to stop it, get out of my way. I'm going to use might, because might makes right, and I'm going to knock anybody down who doesn't, you know, do things my way, because that's a heroic, manly, masculine way to be. Yet your hero is this poor, scared, alone, terrified little creature.
Yeah, I think that's a flaw in my book. I think you're exactly exactly right. And I probably should have... Now I kind of want to rewrite it.
But you know, he's powerless. Like, a lot of the book is about this powerless creature. And I'm wondering if you could speak to, like, is that something that you were careful about in the execution of the work? Is, like, exploring what powerlessness does and what that journey is like?
I think so. And actually, to be serious, I keep coming back to that idea where there's no bravery without fear, right? That's what makes you brave, is overcoming fear, right? And so the core of that book is, like, well, the conceit of the book is that it's a flip-flopped adventure story, or like your typical adventure story where the big strong heroes go into a dungeon and they slay the goblins and they take the treasure. And every time that happened, I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons and love The Hobbit too, but every time that happened, The Hobbit, they actually get pulled into the dungeon. But anyway, every time I read these stories, I think, like, well, what about the goblins? Because they're always the smallest, weakest characters in these fantasy universes. And
do we need to define the difference between an orc and a goblin?
Do we? I don't think. I don't know. These people, everybody, right? Come on.
We know the difference. Orcs big, goblins small.
Orcs are big, and goblins are definitely always these little ones.
Right.
And I wanted to write a story for the goblins, and to me, the more I started thinking about it, the more I was like, oh, we're the goblins, you know? It's a story for the goblins, and that's us. That's part of us, part of everybody is a goblin, I think. And so, yeah, I do like that. I do like the idea of powerlessness, because part of us, you know, we all feel a little bit powerless, and especially children who are the smallest in the world, and they're going out into it, and it is big and scary. But I also think another thing I keep kind of returning to is the idea of home, and then the big world, the adventure, and then what you bring back home after you leave it. Because in overcoming the fears, like, so fear is a constant, like, fear is something, like, you're not brave without fear, but by being brave, by maybe not even, you don't smash down fear, but you kind of overcome it in whatever way you do, and how does that change you, right? So when the character comes back home, what has changed? What has changed?
I heard a review of Zeta the Space Girl years ago, and it was by two young people who did, like, an audio sort of Siskel and Ebert movie reviewer kind of review of the book. And they were talking about Zeta's magic power or superpower was friendship, right?
Yeah.
Her power, she doesn't have power. She doesn't shoot laser beams out of her eyes, but she's really good at connecting with people and helping them and thereby gaining their trust and their help.
Right.
So I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, well, and that's also the Superman problem. Superman wears a cape and Superman is heroic, but he's also, in most stories, almost completely invulnerable, right? Zeta, it's so funny for me to think about it because she's like a normal, like whatever age, 10-ish year old girl. And so that's like, and with no real superpowers at all. But yeah, her power is sort of collecting friends or inspiring people with her own sort of sense of what we should do, what's right, we should help. And so she tends to collect even like the gruffest, gruff characters, kind of the characters who are not like the greatest on their own, but when they sort of start to like congeal around her or
congeal.
Yeah. When her friends congeal around her, that's kind of, they do, they kind of form a protective shell around her. And, yeah.
That's a very, it feels very opposite of the story of the resilient, strong, rugged individualist.
Right.
Who single-handedly sees the solution to the problem and is the only one to solve the problem. This is something where it's really a hero who asks for help. Like, I think about, I'm going to dig a little bit back a few years, like 30 years ago, there was a show called Thundercats.
Mm-hmm.
And the main hero of the show would call, he had this magic sword. And what'd the magic sword do? He could go, Thundercats, ho, and this signal would go up and all of his friends would come help him.
Oh, he calls his friends.
He calls his friends for help. He is not the single hero who can solve everything. And I remember that was something that felt very unique at the time as a child. It was like a message that I didn't get
much. I didn't get it at the time, but you are absolutely right. That's what the Sword of Omens does. It calls your friends.
It calls your friends. Oh. So I'm wondering if like this comes from, like, what experiences from your life do you recollect? Does this come from your life, this worldview of amassing friends is the power?
I think so. I mean, I'm fairly, I come back and back and return to the idea of building your own, I call it like build your own family, or, but it's really like gathering a community or actually finding friends. You are the kindness or lack of it that you've given to the world, right? Those kinds of decisions you make, they're long lasting. And so in a lot of the stories, you know, if I took a look back at the books I've worked on, that's a kind of a theme that keeps coming. So Zeta gathers friends. Goblin is as strong as when he, you know, finds almost his own community, right? Mm-hmm. Julia's house is another one where she's alone, and part of it is not just gathering the friends, but learning how to live together with them.
Can we talk a little bit more about this friendship thing from this panel that got dropped from the book?
Oh, yeah.
So you can come check this out later, but up here, there's a panel where the goblin has come back home, comes up to the cave, and all...
Oh, no. See, he's out. He's still... This is the midpoint. He's out in the world.
Out in the world. Okay.
And he finally finds... He's at his lowest point. He's alone, and he's like, Troll was right. Nobody... Because Troll at the beginning says, nobody... Be careful out there. Nobody likes a goblin. And then goblins... At the lowest point, he's being hunted. Where's the troll? Troll. Are we looking for Troll?
Oh, no, I was just looking. Okay. There's Troll back there. Yeah. And then he's hunting. There's all these great...
Everybody's after him.
This poor little goblin. There's so many angry people.
And it's right here where they're at the lowest point of the cave. They're being hunted. They're hiding in a cave. Just him and his one friend, Skeleton. He has one friend. And he's like, Troll's right. Nobody likes a goblin. And a Skeleton says, you know, well, I like a goblin. And then he discovers that he's in a cave full of these other goblins who've been hiding in this cave as well.
Right.
And that's when everything turns, when he finds them.
And now Goblin has this little crown.
Yeah.
And one of the creatures points to him and says, hey, the crown, are you the Goblin King? And he looks up, but then Skeleton comes in and says, yeah, you are the Goblin King. And then Goblin closes his eyes like, yeah, I am the Goblin King.
I am the Goblin King.
And what I love about this is it's also your friends giving you the reassurance and the support to say, like, no, you know what? You actually are awesome. Because it's kind of...
And informing your identity, right?
Yeah.
Part of your identity is formed by what your friends think of you. Like, that's part of who you become.
You're a big fan of Wizard of Oz. There's that line. the Tin Man. The heart is not judged by how much you love.
But how much others love you.
Yeah, like, but how much you are loved by others,
You are loved by others, yeah, right.
Essentially the same idea, right? So like there's like a reflection that comes out of...
Yeah.
So building your identity by seeing the feedback that you get from the people that you gather around yourself. Yeah. That's interesting. All right, let's talk about process a little bit.
Okay.
How many times do you draw these pages? How many drafts? I saw a picture
Depends
of you...
Depends on the page.
I saw a picture of you posted online where you were sitting over a light box.
Yeah.
And yeah, and there was like an early version of the page, and then you were working on a second version of the page. You know, something when I teach classes for young people, and this idea of first draft. Who's here who's done first draft, second draft, final copy? Any of us? A few of us?
Yeah.
Something that we deal with in school, right? And it's kind of a drag. It's like, I got the idea. It's perfect right now. Here you go. Done, right? That's how it is with this, right?
And I pretend like that we're our watercolor discussion. Oh, the watercolors are partially in control. But I am fairly meticulous about my process. I don't want to be like, oh, and I just like sit down at the page and I put on classical music and it flows out. But no. So layout and design, page design and all these things, they go through drafts and drafts. Can I tell you about... couple of adventures.
That would be great.
So I do like the idea of trying to, in whatever way, connect the drawings or an illustration to the life around you. And I had remembered, I still live in the same sort of general area of where I went to college. And I remember we went out once to visit this cave. We actually ended up staying all night in this cave. But you have to go down these railroad tracks to get to it. And then you climb up this hill. And then there's this cave in the side of the thing. And you can actually probably really informed a lot of Goblin now that I'm thinking about it. But I had remembered this a long time ago. And, I'm getting a faraway look in my eyes now. I'm thinking about that when coming back from that cave. Anyway, I'm not gonna tell that story.
Oh, that's a tease.
Okay, so I stay all night in the cave with a couple of friends, but another person we had along with it was this beautiful girl, and I was walking her back, and I was gonna go back to the cave, and it was Anna. It's my wife. And it was the first time that we, like, walking back at night on the railroad tracks, it was the first time we held hands.
Oh, wow.
So, years and years and years later, I was riding Goblin, and I was like, oh, I want something to be near that cave. And so I took my friend Andy, and it was a cold day. It was, like, January or something. I was like, we've got to hike to this cave, and he had never been out to it. So we got kind of dressed for adventure, and we went and we found the cave, and it had these little... it had been icy and it was melting, so it had these, like, do you remember the tree spirits from Princess Mononoke?
Those little guys with the rattle heads that go.
It had these, like, ice things that looked just like those. They were about, like, this high, and it was really so cool to see. And so we found the cave, and this looks really nothing like it, but it's vaguely the one where Troll is coming out of the cave here. It really doesn't look all that similar, but I had been going through a bunch of photos. I went out to that cave when I was preparing to draw that drawing and had been looking at a bunch of photos.
Wow.
So I like the idea of, and it seemed like the outside scenes are November-ish, which was when I was first starting to put together that. So I like the idea of connecting things to in some way to the world around you. And then, how many times do you do these drawings? Sometimes, the process for them, is this interesting? Is this cool? Okay, I'm just going to tell it quick. The process for them is like many, many versions of a layout, and then
What does a layout look like?
Probably a small version, like a thumbnail version, very scribbly, getting all the characters in the right place, getting the poses how you want them. Just a very small, sketchy version of it. And I blow that up into a pencil drawing that I... can erase and move things around until I have a nice pencil drawing of it. And that's when you see me on the light table, because then I put the watercolor paper down on top of that and do ink over that. And then I take the watercolor paper up to the desk and watercolor it.
Whoa, wait a minute. You watercolor over top of the inked drawing?
Yeah.
See, me and a bunch of other cartoonists were trying to like deconstruct your process, and we were like, surely he watercolors it first, then put the ink on top.
Nope, I just pour the watercolors right on top of the ink.
Wow.
And if I need to re-ink bits of it to get it darker, I'll do it.
Okay.
But But yeah, basically watercolor on top of ink. Yeah.
So how many versions of that? That's at least three times.
That's at least three times, and then I take it to the quality control department, or the quality control department walks upstairs and visits me. That's my wife and my kids, and they usually just check on me, and it's all cool and everything. But this one here, where Goblins Crossing the Mountains, right in the corner here, I did a first version of that, and they were like, "Oh, that's good." And then I threw that version away. And I spent a couple more days redoing it. So anyway, that sometimes happens.
So can you tell the story about how Angelica, your daughter Angelica, helped save a page when you... Yeah, because I love this idea of, like, there's also a narrative that's quite popular mm-hmm. to this day of the single genius... Right? The Edison, the Steve Jobs, it just came fully formed from their mind. And like they came in the room and they said, "I want five versions of this by 5 o'clock.
Right.
Because I know, and all of you people just make it happen."
Yeah.
Surely that's what graphic novelists do as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now we know.
Yeah. No, there's a lot. We were talking about that, and there's a lot of that. I keep coming up with more examples of this. Like Iron Man is another one, right? Mm-hmm. Tony Stark goes down into his basement and with nothing else, no help, no input from anybody else, he comes up with the Iron Man suit.
Right. Yeah, works.
That's another
secret.
Lone genius thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that exists at all.
No.
I think everybody's a product of the ideas that they're surrounded by and the ideas that they plagiarize. And the help that they get, right? It goes back to, but because the idea is they plagiarize, goes back to the idea of it's not really plagiarism. It's, you know, that concept of how to steal like an artist.
How to steal like an artist.
The idea that your artistic styles is partially you and how you see the world, but it's also a lot of the other stuff that you've digested, right? A lot of the things that you've come to love. Boulder and Fleet. Would there be Boulder and Fleet without...
He's talking about a comic that I make.
without He-Man, without Thundercats, right?
My childhood influences, of course, and then also things that my wife says, and then experiences that I've had. And I want to round back on that experience.
And then feedback that you get kind of changes the course of it as it goes, maybe.
So tell the story of Angelica doing just that.
So leading up to that, like I get visited by my kids while I'm working, fairly regularly. And one time my daughter Angelica, I was working on a page in Julia's house, and the watercolor did decide it wanted to do something different and something that I felt was just awful. There was this big kind of running splotch. It was a big spread in the book, and at the far end there was this big purple creature. And the watercolor just kind of like did this thing that I thought was terrible. It just kind of fled away from the corner, made a big splotchy thing. And Angelica came in and she just kind of gave me this coloring advice, and it kind of saved the drawing. She was like, just darken this background, and then do this, and I did. And thanks to her, I did not redo the entire spread because it was just the one creature on the end, and it ended up looking fine.
I've worked with a lot of different people in comics, and one of the biggest questions we get is, well, who did what? Right. Who did the drawing? Who did the writing? Because they're separate things, right? And whenever I come off of the project, it's like we forget who did what. It becomes really hard to tell.
Yeah.
Like I think I don't know because like you're so caught up in the excitement of making a thing and the agony of solving creative problems.
And that's collaboration, right?
Yeah.
But like I'm thinking almost you're reminding me of this idea of like not just collaboration but like unconscious collaboration where it's working with somebody that you don't even realize you're doing it, right? Because I would say like Julia's house has just my name on it, right?
Yeah,
but there's other people involved,
right? There's an editor and there's designers and then there's
the people who come in and say, oh, you can save that drawing, or there's like Julia's got a lot of personality similarities to my mom. So
in a way, where authors are kind of like administrators in that way.
Sure. Right? Yeah. It's a mysterious thing.
Totally is. But yeah, that's one of the things that it's really hard to explain. And it's, you know, you deal with it as you get the questions like, what did you do? And what did your daughter do? Right.
But I think like, and not to get too philosophical, but that's like where the Greeks keep talking about the muse, because there's a whole side of the process that you can kind of pick it apart. Mm-hmm. But when you think of all those moving parts, it becomes so mysterious. because there's so much going on. Mm-hmm. The Angelicas that come in and say you can save that drawing versus the when somebody says, oh, that's good, and you throw it away, and then the where all the ideas come from, that you can see where people would just like throw up their hands and say, no, it's a total mystery. We'll call it the muse. Like, that's where it comes from.
Do you guys want to see the muse at work? See, has that happened live? Live readings are very popular, but I'm interested in getting you to do a live writing for us.
A live writing?
A live writing for us.
You're really putting me on the spot.
I think you got the chops.
Okay. if you believe in me, Jersey,
well, then I can believe in you. Anything. And I'm going to make it easy for you by picking a moment of like great emotional resonance. Right. Okay. So I do this exercise with my students where I say, like, write down the first name of your best friend, write down the name of your secret crush, so a teacher who really helped you, all these different personalities and people who had a real profound emotional impact on your life. So talk about that cave. Talk about the first time you held hands with Anna. Right.
Yes.
If you were to be, I want to talk about visuals as adjectives, right?
Okay.
What would that scene look like? Like, what would be the moments you would collect for representation in a book? Put yourself in that moment. And you're not constructing sentences here, but more like giving us the constellation of what do all the pieces of that moment look like in the author's mind?
Like the visuals?
If you were visually representing it, yeah. Like, what would you collect from that? And why are you choosing them to communicate what feeling? That's the live writing aspect.
Railroad tracks, knit glove.
Looking down at the railroad tracks, off in the distance.
Down at the railroad tracks, the knit glove. Is there one where you can put like the worry of hearing a train whistle in the distance?
What would that look like? What would it look like worrying about a train in the distance?
That would probably have to be done as a thought bubble where somebody's talking and the other person is thinking about a train whistle and like slightly worried in the back of their mind where the other person's not at all worried.
Right.
I'm not going to say which person would be worried about the train whistle. It's me. Spoiler alert, it's me. And we could look into the future.
Oh.
From that moment.
We're looking into the future right now.
We are actually looking into the future right now. They're there waving at me. Another spoiler alert, my family's upstairs.
And like a close shot of the fingers almost touching, just the hand.
And stars. Cold stars, because it's so cold. Part of it is a cold, cold time.
The silhouette of the mountains and the silhouette of the people with the tracks going off.
Moon over the river would be a good one, because railroad tracks right along the Shenandoah River, so we could do moon along the river.
And then like maybe even like the movement of the grass on the side of the tracks or something like that as the feet move by.
Yeah, that would be good. But forest on either side, dark forest would be my, yeah.
So I think that's fascinating. Like, every author's going to notice different things, right?
Right, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Right?
See, well, I'm fixating on, okay, here's the worry of the train whistle. I'm actually also fixating in my mind on there's a spot where you walk and there's like a, it goes over, how do you explain it even? There's like a, not a bridge, but a small cubby-sized underpass.
Mm.
So the worried person could be thinking, oh, we could go up under into there. Or also maybe the adventurous side of the worried person could say, like, wouldn't it be fun to sit under there as a train is going over you?
Right, yeah.
So little bits, so I definitely like visually put that into it.
I don't want to get too, again, to avoid being too philosophical, but there is like what you don't show and what you do show.
Yeah.
There's a syncopation between those two things, isn't there?
Those are deeply personal things. Those are very personal decisions that make your work different from everybody else's work.
Whereas if I were to describe for you a scene where you're watching two people move across a horizontal plane and saying, what kind of boys do you like? What kind of girls do you like?
Mm-hmm.
And having those kinds of questions back and forth, those flirtatious questions, and we just see them just side by side at the same angle, it would feel potentially very dry and maybe even like a little bit lonesome. Right, whereas
unless that's what you're going for. There's so many things. Like, so any scene could be written to feel so many different ways.
Right. Notice none of this had anything
to do with... That's a good writing exercise, though. Like take the same sequence of events and how many emotional versions of that can you go through?
I teach that class at the Art Center.
That's what you do. Yeah, that's it. Okay, good job. I'm going to come take your class.
What is the inroad to discovering a path and to get from like basic watercolor to this? Yeah. What's your path?
I think one thing, well, I know that the sets that we use, I think are actually really good for introductory watercolor. The things we have little watercolor notebooks. This is what my girls use. And then a small like Winsor Newton watercolor kit. And I don't think it's too expensive. It's just like a 12 square a thing with a little brush included. And the thing opens up so you can use the other side, the lid, as for your little puddles. But I think the most important thing about that, or the thing that strikes me the most about it, is that the watercolor notebook itself, the sheets are not too big, because I think starting with, like, when you're starting out, I think starting with a small space, a smaller page is better, because if you're starting with anything with watercolor, anything approaching even like 8.5 by 11 size, it's just a little too much space to fill. And I don't know. I think that's where I'd start. But the other thing is just in drawing in general and art in general, it's good to not feel like you have the supplies are a limited resource. Which is harder for watercolor paper, because it's not the cheapest paper in the world. But for drawing in general, we just make sure to have we got $2 reams of recycled copy paper, and kids can feel like there's an unlimited supply of that, right? So that means they don't have to be precious about their drawings, because there's more copy paper.
Ben, I have an epic in my brain, and it's so big. It's 1,000 Star Destroyers versus 1,000 X-Wing fighters, and it is the most amazing thing you're ever going to see. I can't put it on a tiny little canvas like that. That is too small in scope for my brilliance.
Oh, you mean your single piece is going to be 1,000 Star Destroyers?
Yeah, I need big canvas to start this thing to capture all of my imagination.
You could go one of two ways with that. Yeah. Have you drawn an X-Wing fighter before?
Well, no, but I've seen them in the movies. It's X. How hard can it be?
Yeah, we'll start with an X-Wing fighter.
Yeah, but I need 1,000 of them.
Okay.
Right?
I think you should start with an X-Wing fighter. But if you want to jump right into 1,000 X-Wing fighters, actually, I think you should just go for it. You could get a roll of butcher's paper.
Yeah.
And just sweep it out, or a draw wall. Those are fun.
Those are fun. One here.
But I am an advocate of starting small. I think, like, because a lot of people have a 500-page comic that they've got. Oh, it's all in my head. But I think step by step is how things are created.
Do you remember Kazu Kibuishi's statement of the five steps of creating something?
I love that.
Can you recite it?
This is going to be awesome.
Yeah. This is hard.
This is terrible. I'm terrible. This isn't so bad?
This isn't so bad.
This isn't so bad. That was fun, maybe? Was it? Or just
that was awesome, yeah.
That was awesome, and then you go back to the beginning.
Okay, so you've been doing this how many years?
I don't know. What would you say, Anna? Just as making comics and picture books?
Yeah.
More or less full-time? We'll say 10 years.
10 years. Sure, of course, that five steps that Kazu explained, that goes away because you're good at it now, right?
Yeah, then you get like super confident, and basically you can actually punch your way through any...
Yeah, Eye of the Tiger's playing all the time.
Yeah,
in your studio.
Yeah.
And it's not even on the radio. It just comes out of you.
It actually comes out of the walls.
No, it doesn't go away. Yeah.
No, I go through the same steps.
So, in other words, if you're doing an 800-page epic, that means you're going to go through, this is going to be awesome, this is terrible, I'm terrible, hey, not so bad, hey, that was awesome again. And you're going to go through that over and over and over, and there's plenty of chances to quit. Whereas if you do something tiny, you only go through it once.
Yeah. Or you do it, you go on a smaller loop, right?
And you get evidence of that you can do it.
And that's the key thing to actually creating another thing, is having the evidence that you have done the first thing. So if you are going to start on this epic scale thing, your evidence that you have done something, because you do grow in confidence a little bit, because you have physical evidence that you did a thing.
Right.
A little bit, right? It helps a little bit. So, I think doing a small thing gives you the evidence that you did this small thing. Hey, I did this thing.
Yeah.
And then...
Now I've got a stack of small things.
Yeah.
Well, that's almost a big thing. Maybe I can take on a big thing.
Yeah.
What were the little things that led to the big thing of Zeta the Space Girl, if any?
No, there were a lot of little things that led to the big thing of Zeta the Space Girl. There were Zeta the Space Girl webcomics, which were intentionally little things. Actually, going back to Kazu, he had been doing his copper comics, and he had mentioned online or emailed me something about it where he said, like, I'm doing this to teach myself to tell a small story.
Art as, like, scientific experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
he
wanted
to do
that stuff.
A single page, really, story.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's a good way to learn. So I did that, sort of a similar experiment. And then even after doing those, you know, those 1 to 2 page comics, then I did the Flight Anthology comics, which are also short stories. And then they come out in a book, and you're like, hey, I did a story, and it's in a book. And you know, it's 10 pages, but that's longer than my webcomic was. So you've got, like, I did definitely step up to that. And
Yeah, there's a term in teaching, if there's any educators in the room, called risk diminishment, where you slowly acclimate the students to progressively more difficult challenges. And so you start out with an easy little thing to prove that, hey, look, you came out the other side okay.
Yeah.
And now you came out twice okay. All right, now it's time for a test. Aww. But still, yeah. you know now, you have evidence that you can pull this thing off, right?
And yet, doing a full length book like that felt like a very big jump. Still, it was still a big, scary jump.
Do the tools change between the small things to the big things?
In comics. Not for what I was doing.
No.
I mean, I was still doing pages kind of the same way.
Okay.
Why?
I just mean like when I do small comics, I sometimes like, okay, I'm gonna do a small comic entirely digitally. I'm gonna do a small comic, but I'm just gonna use markers. I'm gonna do a small comic, but I'm just gonna use, you know, go straight from thumbnails to brush ink. Okay. And I'll use that as a way to say, like, can I do what I want to do with these tools? And then when I do a big thing, it's like, okay, I'm gonna take what I learned from all these little projects and pump it into this big project. Do you do anything like that?
Yeah. I feel like not for me. I know I feel like I did the pages from the books pretty much the same way I did the pages for the online.
So maybe the experimentation is more isn't like in the actual...
In storytelling.
Storytelling.
And actually breadth of story and learning to thumbnail out the whole thing in advance and stuff like this.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
A great animator named Tom Seto once said that when you're thinking of a story, like you think of like Moby Dick, nobody, when you say that title, very few people, I should say, would think, call me Ishmael, one day when I was feeling so-and-so, I went down to the sea. What you think of, you just think of that scene with Ahab on the whale screaming, right? Like there's this visual image and it's not in sequential order. So my follow-up, building on your question, is when you say, go to your editor, I have this thing I want to do called Nobody Likes a Goblin. It starts off with, right, or do you have like these big moments like, you know, Ahab on the whale? Does it appear in your head sequentially, or does it appear in like moments that you have to sequence?
Probably moments or even themes that I can't get away from. Because Goblin Book was weird because the book I kind of pitched was really different from this. And so there was a lot of things where I had to narrow it down to, like, there were a lot of different things going on, and I finally had to zero in on, oh, I only care about the goblins part of this story. And then carving that away to, oh, I actually only care about this little goblin for this story. Because, like, you know, the original versions had, like, modern-day parts with kids and other things. I don't know. Just really weird, bad versions of this story. No, they were terrible. They were so bad. And then, like, even a couple of them were, like, I wouldn't say cleared by my editor, but, like, she was definitely like, oh, I'm on board for this story. And I got more and more uncomfortable about it until I was like, actually, you know, I'm changing everything. That version of the story is gone.
You have a very open and receptive personality.
Okay.
And I've noticed that you're not the kind of person who's like closes yourself off easily. I mean, you for self-care and for protecting yourself, yes, but like you don't seem like a very aloof or cold person. You feel very warm.
Mm-hmm. It's just a persona jersey.
Well, sure, that's just that's your outside Ben. No, but like there's this sort of like, okay, we're gonna find out what happens now kind of attitude about your interactions with the people, which I feel like is kind of an author's disposition. Like a good author is like open to like, okay, we're gonna find out what's going on now. This is weird, you know.
Yeah, I think you have to try, and I think it opens you up to like. you know, not everything that's going to happen when you do that is going to be great.
Yeah.
But I love the part in The Hobbit where he says, you know, adventures aren't all pony rides in May sunshine.
Yeah.
It's raining. It's awful. But he's actually having an adventure, and it leads him to become the changed person that he is when he comes back. And so I think, and then, you know, what Bilbo does when he comes back home is he starts writing a book.
Right.
So
right, yeah.
I think that is kind of part of the whole deal. And it's hard sometimes because, it can be scary, right?
Yeah.
Painful. Yeah, and painful. Yeah, to walk through life and be like, okay, I'm open to whatever this is. And but I think that's the job. I think that's part of the job because you want to feed. You know, like a lot of storytelling is digesting experiences, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to feed that. You want to continue to feed that. And it gets harder too because you know, there's that Douglas Adams thing where he says, like, you've got your whole life to make your first book, and then you've got, like, 6 months to make your next one. and so you're drawing from, like, all this experience for the first one, and then, like, okay, now what do I... So you have to kind of make time to go and do. And
the reward for being kind of good at it is they're like, okay, where's the next one?
Yeah, that happens.
It's a good problem to have, though. Yeah, I also think there's, like, a C.S. Lewis quote that I love where he talks about, it was worth such pain to love so much.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, what a scary quote.
That is a very scary
it's
quote.
It's terrifying. Yeah.
Final
okay,
question.
Final thought.
Instead of favorite character, what's your favorite kind of painting? Watercolor, oil, acrylic, gouache?
Watercolor for the experience, oil painting for the smell.
That's a good one.
I love the smell of linseed oil. It's the most magical smell.
All right, well, with that, I want to thank the Ann Arbor District Library one more time
thank
for putting
you,
on this
library.
Show. It's the best library. And thank you, Ben Hatke, for sharing your work with us and all of your thoughts today.
Thank you, my friends.